ॐ भद्रं कर्णेभिः शृणुयामदेवाः भद्रं पश्येमाक्षभिर्यजत्राः स्थिरैरङ्गैस्तुष्टुवांसस्तनूभिः व्यसेमदेवहिदं यदायुः. O Almighty Lord, may we hear with our ears what is auspicious. May we see with our eyes what is auspicious. May we, while offering our praise to the Almighty Lord, with our bodies strong of limbs, enjoy the life which the Almighty is pleased to grant us for the good of the whole creation. All peace, peace, peace. In the 29th verse, there is a well-known description of mind, this mysterious phenomenon that we call mind. And in course of time, the author tries to give a graphic description of the subtle nature of mind and also how to control mind. I shall just read the 29th verse.
Yatha supne dvayabhasam spandade mayaya manaha tatha jagrit dvayabhasam spandade mayaya manaha.
The prose order is this: yatha supne manaha mayaya dvayabhasam tatha jagrit manaha mayaya dvayabhasam vindade spandade. This is the meaning here. Now, in English we can say, just as in dream the mind vibrates through maya, through delusion, as though it has got dual roles, two roles. So also in the waking state, the mind vibrates through maya as though with dual roles. Now, I shall explain this. Now, in waking state, in our normal human experience, you find the mind divides itself into two parts. The experiencer and the experienced, the seer and the seen. In Sanskrit, it is called drashta, who is a seer, and drishtam, which is seen, subject and objects. In fact, that's our normal experience. When we walk through streets, when we see objects with our eyes, and when we perceive the existence of different visual objects with the help of mind and eyes, what happens? The subject knows the object. The object is objectified. It is perceived. It is seen. Or it is perceived by hearing. You may perceive the existence of incense stick by its perfume. You may perceive the existence of a moving object or a vehicle or a car or a train by the sound it creates. And you may perceive the existence of the table in front of you, even when your eyes are closed, by touching it. You may perceive the taste of a candy with the help of the sense of taste, the tongue, and so on. So in all these cases, you and the experienced, the object that is perceived, these are the two roles which mind plays. The same mind plays the role of subjects and the role of objects. This is our whole human experience in everything, the subject and object. Subject is called in Sanskrit grahaka, means something which perceives. Grahyam is something which is perceived, the objects. Now, here Gaudapada makes an interesting point. In waking state, we know very well that mind is the same, one entity which divides itself into subject and object. And in dream also the same thing is happening. One may ask the question, in dream, your eyes are closed, you are seeing things. So, where are the objects that are perceived? Now, what happens? In dream, the mind throws up the visual objects from the memory related to experiences that we have gathered in waking state. So that is very obvious. Everyone can understand very easily if he is told that in dream, the mind divides itself into subject and objects. There is no external object. Very obvious. Your eyes are closed. You are seeing yourself walking in the street and you are seeing moving cars, vehicles, trains and so on. So naturally, there are no visible objects in dream. Mind itself clearly becomes the objects and mind itself is the subjects. So that's very obvious. Now Gaudapada equates waking state experience with dream experience. It is certainly going too far from a purely empirical point of view. But from a philosophical point of view, it is not going too far. He says, this author says, in waking state also the same thing is happening. The objects are nothing but a projection of the mind. The same mind becomes the objects and the same mind becomes the subjects. That's obvious. So, in Gaudapada's philosophy, the empirical world, the world in which we live, is as perishable, as peripheral, as transitory, as non-permanent, as the experiences in dream. Sometime back I gave this example. If you think of the total lifespan of an average person, maybe he may live for 90 years and he may sleep for 8 hours a day, which means for 30 years he's sleeping, he's dreaming. 60 years, of course, he's alive. But when we ask him, how old are you? He doesn't say, I'm 60 years old. He would say, I'm 90 years old. The 30 years in which he did not do anything from an external empirical point of view, except sleeping, is also counted. So he is 90 years old. So what does it mean? The difference is the waking state is twice as long as the dream state. But dream state is not non-existent. The difference is only the difference in degrees, not difference in kind. But both are equally peripheral, transitory. We know very well that the dream experience is certainly not permanent. That is very obvious. Everyone knows. Well, what is waking state experience other than an extended dream experience? That's what Gaudapada asks. In dream also, you have seen, you have walked, you are eating food, you are drinking water, you are traveling, everything you are doing. But only for 30 years, because you sleep 8 hours every day. But in the waking state, you do it for 60 years, that's all. So both are equally a projection of the mind, in which mind divides itself into subject and object. If you go beyond this subject-object division, then you go beyond mind. And that is the real purpose of Vedanta. In Buddhist tradition, in Shunyavada Buddhism, in the meditative techniques, this is done by detaching the mind from the external objects. By looking upon the external objects as detached, fleeting consciousness, streams of consciousness. So you just look at things, you don't identify with what comes in the mind. The moment you learn to de-identify, detach your mind from the external objects, then you go beyond mind. In Vedanta, the approach is slightly different. In Vedanta, we do not just detach the mind from external things. Because the moment you detach mind from external things, external objects cease to exist. And if there are no external objects to be objectified, to be perceived, then the mind also loses its role of a subject. Because the role of subjects, it is logical only in the context of external objects. Experiencer exists only if experienced exists. If there is nothing to be experienced, then you are not even experiencer. Then you go beyond both. But Vedanta, the approach is different. Vedanta says, well, this is all right. You can detach your mind from external objects. If you are meditating, if you are thinking, if you are sitting somewhere, and if thoughts arise, emerge in the mind, which are conflicting thoughts, distressing thoughts, problematic thoughts, as they apply in modern psychiatry. You try to look upon these thoughts as a detached witness, not as a participant, but as a witness. See, you are sitting in a theater watching a drama. You don't feel the pain inflicted by the villain on the hero in the drama that is going on at the stage. Because you are a witness. Similarly, whatever emerges in the mind should be looked upon with a sense of detachment. You are not a participant in the drama of experiences. You are just a witness. This is developed into a very high degree of perfection in modern meditative techniques. But in Vedanta, the approach is somewhat different. Vedanta asks the question, who am I? Well, at various levels, we identify ourselves in various dimensions. Sometimes we feel we are not different from the external objects. We identify ourselves with external objects. If something happens to another person, we feel the pain. So I mean, you are identifying yourself to be the other person. It's close identification. And sometimes going beyond the external things, we identify ourselves with our senses. And sometimes we identify ourselves with the mind. And sometimes we identify ourselves with the intellect. So there are different levels of identification. At the grossest level, we identify ourselves with the external objects. At a higher level, we identify ourselves with the senses which perceive the external objects. At a still higher level, we identify ourselves with the mind which uses the senses to pursue external objects. Without the mind, the eyes cannot see, the ears cannot hear. So mind belongs to a higher level in the total human personality. So I'm hungry, I'm angry, thirsty, feeling happy, unhappy. In all these situations, We identify ourselves with our mind. But when you read Aristotle or Kant or Shankaracharya, you feel, not everyone, you feel elated. Reading an abstract metaphysical thesis. But that's not possible. But then there you are identifying yourself as something other than the mind. Because you can even forget your food while reading Aristotle. There you are going beyond the mind. Mind says, I'm hungry. Or mind says, I'm unhappy. But such people can take refuge in higher aesthetic activities, in music, in philosophy, and so on. So there you are identifying yourself as something other than even the mind. But there are situations, there are conditions where you don't even identify yourself as the intellect. You ask the question, who am I? And if you read metaphysics properly, metaphysics, after all, philosophy is a search for truth. Not searching for truth through books, but searching for truth through some higher means, introspection, contemplation. So there you are going away from books. You are transcending the level of the realm of intellect. So asking the question, who am I? What's the meaning of life? What's the meaning of existence? What's the ultimate destiny of creation? These questions are possible only for people who have spirit, who are intellectually evolved to a very high level. Now, at this level, you are going beyond even intellect. Now, Gaudapada says, we are neither this body, nor the external objects, nor the mind, nor even the intellect. Though intellect will help you to understand these higher metaphysics, but intellect sorts far behind. It cannot reveal the truth, because the truth can be revealed only at the experience level, which is both beyond the mind and also beyond the intellect. So at that time you ask the question, who am I? So I am not this external objects, nor mind, nor intellect. I am the immanent consciousness, the all-pervading transcendental reality, which is called Atman or Brahman in Vedantic language. Once you identify yourself with this Atmanhood, with this Atman consciousness, then mind ceases to exist. Means you transcend mind. So mind should be understood as a kind of stream consciousness, an endless stream of thought currents coming one after another. Vedanta gives a simple definition. It says, Sankalpa Vikalpatmika Antakarana Vrittihi Mana. This is the simplest definition. There are many, of course, definitions. Now, mental vibrations functioning as thought currents, positive thought currents and negative thought currents. This is what mind is all about. When you see an object from a distance, or when you hear something, or when you think of something, mind projects various thought currents. There is a variety of thought currents emerging in the mind. Now, mind is not an entity. Mind is a continuous and continual, both can be used, flow of thought currents. So, according to Buddhist Vijnanavada school, the subject to idealistic school, mind is a platform, chittam as you call it, in which all these thought currents come and go, which project external objects, which really do not exist apart from the mind. Because mind alone exists, external objects have no independent existence, independent of mind, according to Buddhist subjective idealists. But Vedanta says, Well, mind is nothing but a stream of thought currents, which could be positive thought currents, sankalpa and vikalpa, different, diverse thought currents. When you see an object from a distance, you may have different options in your mind. It could be Vedantic language, it could be a post, or it could be the form of a human being. It could be anything. All these thought currents will come. Mind is functioning. And when you come near the object, when you are sure, well, this is a ball or a post or whatever it is, not a human being. When you come to a definite decision as to what the object is, then your intellect functions. Vedanta says, our real human personality, our true nature is beyond all these levels. Our true nature is the all-pervading, the immanent, supreme consciousness, which is existence absolute, knowledge absolute, and bliss absolute, which is beyond words, which is immanent in all beings, and also omnipresent, all-pervading, everywhere. Once you really experience this Atmanhood, our own Atmanhood, then mind ceases to exist. We are not destroying the mind. We are going beyond the mind. Mind cannot be destroyed. So long as we are not aware of our true nature, that we are Atman, mind remains a reality. So mind can never be wished away. It can never be negated. It can only be transcended. It is called Amani Bhava in Vedantic text, including Mandukyakarya, Godapadakarya. Godapada also explains this process of Amani Bhava in the succeeding lines. And once we realize our real nature, our Atmanhood, then all problems come to an end. Then we will be able to live in this world, do our duties, perform our responsibilities, but the world will not shake us. The world will not be a terrible crisis. It will not appear to be a terrible crisis for us. We can live in this world, still we can look at this world as a spectator sitting in a theater, watching the drama that's going on the stage. If we don't realize this, if we don't make an attempt to realize this true nature of ours, we will be playing, we'll be participating in the drama, because we'll be able to detach ourselves from the external objects. We'll be able to look at the drama of human life as a witness, as a spectator, only if we realize that we are something other than the participants who are playing in this drama. And what are the participants? The objects, empirical objects, the senses, the mind, the intellect, all these are different players who are active in this drama of human life. So the best way to look at this drama of human life as a witness, as a subject, as a detached witness, as a detached subject, is to realize this true nature. Before it becomes an experience, we must try to develop this as an intellectual conviction at least. In fact, this is possible even if you realize, even you use your real pure reasoning power. In fact, that is one of the unique characteristics of this text that we are discussing. Gaudapada says, you need not believe in anything. We need not have faith in anything. If you have got faith, fine, nothing, no problem. But it is not indispensable that you should believe in a doctrine or a dogma. You should follow certain rituals. Even if you exercise your reasoning power with independence and freedom, you can arrive at this. So he says, you look at this world. Do you think this world is absolutely real? It is changing every minute, every second. The world is changing. As I said earlier, the world may exist for some millions of years, the universe that we are living in. But before it came into existence, it was not there. And certainly it won't be there after several millions of years. This universe won't be what it is now. So it is also transitory, subject to change. It is only fleeting existence, for the time being, as it is called. For the time being, that expression is as applicable to something which exists for a few seconds and also to the universe which may exist for some millions of years. There's no difference. Now, Gaudapada says, behind all this, there is a permanent reality which never comes into existence. Why? Because it always exists. So it cannot come into existence. Because coming into existence means the transition from a state of non-existence towards a state of existence. It always exists. So it will never vanish. And that is Atman, the Supreme Consciousness. Everything else is a superimposition, as Gaudapada is trying to put in the succeeding lines. The old analogy should be clearly kept in mind. The dark, semi-dark room, an object lying on the floor, a curved object, which is really a piece of rope, but because there is not enough light, we mistake it for a snake. Some others mistake it for a stick, curved stick. Some others mistake it for a thin stream of water. Maybe a fourth person may mistake it for a crack on the floor. All these are possible misunderstandings. There could be, if there are 1,000 people in that semi-dark room, there could be 1,000 different misconceptions. So, superimpositions. But actually it is a piece of rope. Now, when you bring light, the snake doesn't die because the snake did not exist. The stick never gets broken because it was never the stick. It is only a piece of rope. So, when you bring light, the real nature of the object is revealed. It's a piece of rope. Similarly, when we dehypnotize ourselves, Vivekananda uses this expression, dehypnotization. It was Swami Vivekananda who used this particular expression while expounding this higher metaphysics in Vedanta in English language. He used the word dehypnotization. We have now hypnotized ourselves to be, well, I'm the suffering person, I'm the happy one, the unhappy one, all because our mind is divided into subject and objects. So there are different objects in the external world, not necessarily visible objects. Any kind of sensation is an object. Is it not exactly the dictionary meaning that is implied here? Anything that we will, happiness is the result of something happening in the external world. So that is also a kind of object. It's called jnayam, it is called dhyayam. What is known, what is experienced, what is seen, the objectified thing, that's called. So when we respond, when we react to all these external things, we become happy, unhappy, hungry, thirsty, and so on. These are all different kinds of different types of hypnotizations. We hypnotize ourselves into a suffering human being. So Vedanta says, no, we are all in our true nature. In reality, we are all that supreme consciousness, that Atman, which is the absolute existence, the absolute knowledge, and the absolute bliss. And the real purpose of Vedanta is to rediscover this truth. It's not an invention. It is only rediscovery. We are just coming back to our real home. So Vedanta is not about getting a new knowledge. It is all about regaining our lost territory, regaining our lost identity. We are, in fact, that supreme consciousness, the Atman. So the idea that I'm happy, unhappy, etc., all because of our wrong identification of ourselves with our mind, and mind is just a transitory, a fleeting dimension of our total personality. It is not the real dimension of our personality. This is what Gaudapada is going to drive home the next few verses. I have given an outline. Now we'll continue the verses. So, the 29th verse we already discussed. So, the point is this. Just as in dream, the mind vibrates as subject and object, as dual entities. Similarly, in waking state also, the mind vibrates. If we can keep this in our mind, then the whole world becomes a play, a sport. We won't take very seriously. Not that we become indifferent or we become negligent in our duties and responsibilities. It is not a kind of auto-suggestion. Please keep in mind. It's not an auto-suggestion or anything. It is just a statement of the absolute metaphysical and spiritual truth that we are not just this body, mind or intellect or anything, but something that goes beyond all this. So, let's see. Now, Shankaracharya says, as I used to refer to Shankaracharya's words, just as we have wrongly mistaken the piece of rope for the snake, similarly, we have mistaken our true real nature, which is Atman, for something which is essentially transitory, which is subject to change. So we mistake ourselves to be mind, body, intellect, and so on. So yatha rajjvam vikalpyataha sarpo rajjurupena avekshimanaha sannevam manaha paramartha vignyaptyatma rupena avekshimanam sat grahi graha rupena duyabhasam spandade supne maya rajjvam iva sarpa. As Shankaracharya says, our dream is the same as waking state. In other ways, better to say the waking state is the same as dream. This may appear to be something totally shocking to many, but reality is the experience of mind dividing itself into subject and object is natural. That is very, it is obvious with regard to dream experience. Everyone knows that. You are sleeping in a dark room, it's pitch dark everywhere, your eyes are closed, nothing could be seen, but you may see a truck in the small room where you are sleeping. Truck cannot exist there, or an elephant. So where is the elephant? In your mind. So object is in your mind. And who is seeing the mind? Mind is seeing mind. Subject and object, both are two aspects of the same mind. Now Gaudapada says that's true in waking state also. The point is this. I know that needs a lot of explanation, so I shall try to explain it from another angle. Now, Gaudapada says, we create this world with our mind. The world that we experience is essentially the creation of our mind. That's what he says. So, the mind is the subject, mind is the object. The world responds to us according to the way we react to the world. Both are interrelated. I can give one great example from the life of Sri Ramakrishna Paramahamsa, the teacher of Swami Vivekananda. Sri Ramakrishna's teachings are contained in the famous spiritual classic known as the Gospel of Sri Ramakrishna. He was living in a temple, 19th century. He was born in 1836 and passed away in 1886, total 50 years. Now, many people from various walks of life came to visit him, scholars, conventional believers, atheists, theists, agnostics, all people, all sorts of people. Now, and a large number of great mystics also used to visit the temple, visit Sri Ramakrishna and talk to him, engage him in spiritual conversation. So once, a great mystic came there. Now, there was nothing remarkable about this person. He had a small piece of a twig from mango tree. He was very odd-looking person. Very odd-looking person. He was in rags, but he was in a state of ecstasy and bliss. So, looking at the sky, looking at the moon, the sun, the stars, different objects in the universe, he used to dance. Oh, what a glory! What sublimity! He was experiencing the joy of identifying yourself with the entire creation. Now, people may think this is some kind of psychological problem, modern educated people. But a person suffering from any pathological psychiatric problems will not have that state of the bliss, that joyous attitude. And when he spoke, the pearls of wisdom came out of his mouth. What we read in the Upanishads or the Bible or the Vedas, all these spiritual ideas came out of him. And he was in a state of perpetual joy and blissful attitude. Now, for such a person, mind did not exist. Because if mind exists and if we identify ourselves with the mind, we can never be happy in this world. If we identify ourselves with the mind, we can never be happy. Because mind perceives happiness, and next moment it perceives unhappiness. And even if mind is experiencing happiness now, it may be anxious, it may be very much concerned about, how long will this happy state of affairs may continue. So that will lead to unhappiness. So anything other than that spiritual bliss, which is a result of this identification with our true nature, or Atman, Atmanhood as we may call it, is transitory. Now we'll go to the next verse. So for such a person, there is no dream state, no waking state. He had only one state, and that was the state of perpetual bliss. He has gone beyond dream state and he has gone beyond the waking state. Whole existence became a spiritual experience for such a person. It's a classic example. You can come across many such examples in the mythological books. If you read the life of Siddharamangasa Paramahamsa, you will come across many such examples. No, in the next verses, this idea is more elaborated. Adduyam cha dayabhasam mana supnena samsaya. Adduyam cha dayabhasam tatha jagratna samsaya. Supne manaha adduyam dayabhasam cha na samsaya. Tatha jagrat adduyam dayabhasam na samsaya. Now, Gaudapada says, there can be no doubt that the non-dual mind alone appears in dream in dual roles. Non-dual mind actually means what? Non-dual mind is not mind. In fact, mind is nothing but a reflection of the Atman. It's just like a mirror, you know. Now, if you have got a mirror, a clean mirror, which is glittering, very clean, you can get a reflection of the sunlight. But if the mirror is dirty, dusty, then the sunlight will not be reflected. Now, when you see the mirror which is glittering, what exactly is the source of that glittering, the brilliance? It is sunlight. So mind itself, when it's pure, it becomes a reflecting medium for Atman, for our true nature. And then when the Atman, the universal self, reflects through the mind in its full effulgence, then mind goes beyond beyond duality, and then there is no subject-object classification, no subject-object division of the mind. The mind goes beyond the role of subject and goes beyond the role of object. It is neither the subject nor the object. That's why Ramana Maharshi, referring to this point, once said, when mind is turned outward, it is mind. When mind is turned inward, it is not mind, it is Atman. Because mind can never be turned inward. Mind's very nature is oriented towards external objects. Otherwise, you won't feel the presence of mind. We are happy. When we say we are happy, this happiness is felt within mind. So, I am happy when I say I identify myself with the mind. And this happiness is nothing but a state of mental condition in relation to an external object. Something which gives you happiness and you feel happy. So, there is the I who is the subject and the object which gives happiness. Object. So, subject-object classification. So, mind is always turned towards external things. And mind is mind only when it is turned towards external things. Mind ceases to be mind. It becomes non-mind when it is turned inward. When it is turned inward, when it becomes non-mind, it identifies itself with Atman. Just as the clean mirror which reflects the full effulgence of the brilliant sun is identified itself with the sun. Because the brilliance of the mirror is nothing but the brilliance of the sunlight. That's the idea behind it. So, here Gaudapada says, there is no doubt that a non-dual mind alone appears in dream as subject and objects. And that is true in waking state also. There is a famous section in the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, which sometimes I mentioned, you know. It deals with the depiction of Atman as the light of all lights. It's called Jyotisham Jyoti, it is called. So that particular section is called Jyoti Brahmanam, that particular section of the Upanishadic text, which describes Atman as the light of all light. Light here doesn't necessarily mean the external light, the sunlight or moonlight. It goes something beyond that. The story is this, is a famous episode. A great sage and a great king, both are known to each other, friends. There's a dialogue between them. The sage's name is Yajnavalkya and the king's name is Janaka. One day, this great philosopher, sage, visits the king. And the king asks some questions to the sage, this great sage. And he answers these questions. The simple question is, Kim Jyotirayam Purushayiti? This means, the king asked the sage Yajnavalkya, hey Yajnavalkya, what is the light which enables human beings to live in this world, to work in this world, to move about in this world, to exist in this world? And in course of time, Yajnavalkya slowly builds up a compact metaphysical system out of this. First, the king asks the question, by what light do we human beings live in this world, move about, work, go to different places and return home? The simple question. And now the obvious answer is, you know, Surya Jyoti means sun. That's very simple. We will not understand the full metaphysical import of this episode till we come to the last portion of the dialogue. And that opens up a highly celebrated metaphysical discussion of the ultimate principle of existence. So the first question is, by what light do we human beings live in this world and move about doing our duties and responsibilities? Obvious answer is sunlight. No sun, well, suppose there is no sunlight, the sun is set in the west in the evening, then kim jyotirayam purushayiti astamasi surya astamasi yajnavalkya. When the sun is set in the west, then the sage says, when there is no sunlight, then how do we move about? Moonlight. That's clear. Suppose there is neither moonlight nor sunlight. You are in a dark room. What light helps you to see things, to move about? Well, fire, Agnir Jyoti. So Surya Jyoti, that is sun as the light, Chandra Jyoti, moon as the light, Agnir Jyoti, fire as the light. You can say start a fire, or you can just use a matchstick and light a candle. Now, suppose there is neither sunlight nor moonlight nor fire, then Vak Jyoti or Shabda Jyoti, speech, words. Suppose you are sitting in a dark room, no sunlight, no moonlight, no fire. You hear a vehicle, a truck moving in the streets. How do we know about the truck? How do we know that a truck is moving in the street? From the sound. So mind and ears come together and perceive the existence of a moving truck in the streets by hearing the sound that comes from that object. Now, for the fifth question is, suppose there is neither sunlight, nor moonlight, nor fire, and you can't hear us. So no speech, no sound serving as light. Now remember here, light means revealer. Light means something in whose presence things get revealed. Light here doesn't necessarily mean the visible light, the electric light or the light of fire. Not necessarily. It goes beyond that. Though all these have got the name light, because in the presence of sunlight, things get revealed. We are able to see the existence of things. We are able to understand, perceive the existence of things just because there is sunlight. So light is existence. And light is knowledge. Because of sunlight, you are able to see, you are able to perceive the existence of something in front of you. So the sunlight becomes the revealer, and it reveals you the existence of things, and it reveals the existence of things by giving knowledge about the existence of things. And when you get the knowledge, you become conscious of it. So that's true with regard to moonlight, fire, and also the sound, Vagjyoti or Shabdajyoti, the fourth one. Now, the fifth question is, here the king, Janaka, asked the question, suppose there is neither sunlight nor moonlight and no fire, nor matchstick or candle, anything, and no sound, so you can't hear, you are deaf. Still, you are able to see things, hear things. How? From memory. You may have seen something yesterday. You are sitting in a dark room, and these objects which you have seen yesterday are coming back to your mind, and you are seeing them. Seeing doesn't necessarily mean seeing with open eyes. Seeing or hearing could also mean seeing or hearing at the mental level. That's what is happening. That is what is memory. Hearing at the mental level is called memory. See, you listen to a music this morning which you have never heard earlier. This evening you are able to repeat it, practice it. How? You are re-experiencing that hearing experience again at the mental level. A painter sees a master's work in the art gallery. After 10 years, it's possible for, if he's a great painter, to paint a similar picture. How? What he has seen only once is registered, and after 10 years, he can re-experience that visit to the gallery and he can see that paint again at the mental level. So seeing doesn't necessarily mean seeing with eyes or with ears or with any other sense of perception. Not necessarily seeing or hearing or perceiving with the five senses of perception and mind. So memory is also a kind of experience. Now, the great king Janaka asked the question, suppose there is neither sunlight nor moonlight, no fire, no sound, still you are sitting somewhere, you can see, you can hear. What enables you to understand things? Then Yajnavalkya answers the question, Atma Jyoti. Atman, or the Supreme Self, the immanent reality, the absolute immanent reality, the absolute principle, which is the immanent reality in all beings, which is also the transcendental reality, which is the omnipresent reality. This Atma Jyoti enables you to hear, to see, to remember things. And if this Atma Jyoti is not present, eyes will not function, ears will not function. A dead man cannot see or hear, because the soul, the self, has gone away from that body, from the five senses of that body, attached to that body, to somewhere else. It has gone away from there, it has gone somewhere else. It is all pervading, but it has withdrawn itself from that body, or the five senses attached to that body, or the mind and intellect attached to that body's psychophysical mechanism. It has withdrawn itself from it, so it doesn't function. So, Yajnavalkya says, it is Atma Jyoti, which Jyotisham Jyoti, means light of all lights. So light should be understood as something in whose presence things get revealed, things get their experience, things are perceived, from which everything gets its existence. Existence, all existence comes from that light of light. Now, that Atman is beyond subject, beyond object. It's called, Gaudapada uses the term Advaya. And that Atman, in its true nature, is beyond subject, beyond object. It is the eternal witness. Witness sometimes may imply certain objects of which it is a witness. So it should not be taken in that sense. It is a supreme witness, which itself is non-different from the objects. That's the idea. It is a supreme eternal witness. And then in the 34th verse, which is a famous verse, Manodrishyamidam dvaidam yat kinjit sacharacharam manasohi amani bhave dvaidam naivopalabhyate. Amani bhava is a term used here. Mind becoming non-mind. Mind going back to its true nature. Mind becoming non-mind. Mind ceases to be the mind. Because mind itself implies subject-object division. The endless stream of fleeting objects, memories, tendencies, thought currents, etc. All these cease to exist the moment we identify ourselves with our true nature, with this Atman, with the supreme revealer that we have already described, which is neither subject nor object. Or if you want to use one of these terms, you can say it is the eternal subject, Sarva Sakshi. That's how I can use it. And all objects are nothing but projections of this eternal subject. Now we'll continue in the next week. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. Very good.